It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the U.S. Senate is considering Attorney General Eric Holder's replacement today. Loretta Lynch is on the Hill. We'll hear what Congress has to say.
Earlier this month, an investigative report painted a damning picture of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Toma. It found that the number of opioid prescriptions there had more than quintupled since 2004, leading some veterans to call the medical center Candyland.
Since then, there have been numerous developments. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin has come under fire as her office had a similar report, didn't take action on it. At the same time, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is launching its own investigation into the center.
Here to bring us up to speed on what's been happening with this story over the past few weeks is Aaron Glantz, veterans reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be with you.
Well, since the story broke, what's changed, if anything, at the Toma VA facility?
Well, the VA in Toma had been isolated, alone. Many of the people that I talked to in putting together that story were afraid to speak with me on the record because they so feared intimidation from the chief of staff, Dr. David Houlihan, who prescribed an average of 25,000 milligrams of morphine per year to each of his patients. And this is a psychiatrist who is supposed to be, you know, taking care of people's mental conditions rather than physical pain. So very troubling. Since our story ran, both of Wisconsin's U.S. senators have become involved. Congressman Ron Kind, who represents the area around Toma, has also asked for an investigation. Secretary of Veterans Affairs Bob McDonald responded to this by dispatching a team of investigators from Washington to Toma this week, where they are now on the ground looking into it. So something that had been very secret is now out in the open, and people are wondering if this is going to be dealt with.
And as a reporter, are you personally seeing more transparency as you advance the story and cover it?
Well, you know, it's always a game when you're a reporter. People sometimes like to come out and talk to you, and then sometimes they like to hide. But I've seen that a lot of people who were afraid to talk are no longer afraid because they see all of these politicians talking. They see it discussed on the television in Wisconsin, on the public radio in Wisconsin. It's on the front page of the newspaper in their community. And since then, I've learned about many more cases, which hopefully I'll be bringing to your listeners' attention and to readers very soon.
The facility's director is speaking out. What does he have to say about all of this?
He's trying to have it both ways. So this is Mario DeSantis. He's the head of the hospital, the chief of staff who we investigated reports to him. So, you know, he's been in the chair while all of this has been going on, and he's trying to say two things at once. He's trying to say on the one hand, it's all under control. We're already reacting and changing our practices. And on the other hand, he's saying, well, this has to be investigated. These are new allegations and nothing has been proven. Obviously, the fact that the number of opiate prescriptions at the Toma VA quintupled is a fact and not an allegation. The fact that a 35-year-old former Marine overdosed and died in their psychiatric ward in August, as we reported, is a fact, not an allegation. The fact that the number of oxycodone pills given out by the hospital pharmacy went from about 50,000 when Dr. Houlihan became the chief of staff to over 700,000 in 2012 is a fact, not an allegation. And so, you know, people are looking to see, well, what changes on the ground now that all of this is out in the open?
You mentioned Dr. David Houlihan, chief of staff, who was doing the prescribing a lot of it that you were talking about. He's at the center of this story. What's his status right now?
He has been put on paid leave from his position as chief of staff of the hospital, also a nurse practitioner who was worked closely with him, who was also an extremely significant prescriber of narcotics, has also been temporarily moved out of her position. Both of them are not allowed to write any new scripts or see patients pending the conclusion of this investigation that we've been talking about, although I should say both of them, you know, continue to draw government salaries, so we, the taxpayers, are paying for them to ride a desk until this gets resolved.
As of right now, the whistleblower in this case has continued to take an active part. What have we seen him doing?
Well, the individual who brought this to my attention is Ryan Honnell. He is a former scheduling secretary at the VA. He is a Gulf War veteran and a West Point graduate. And he saw a little sliver of this. He just knew something was wrong after working there for less than 2 months last year, and so he quit and filed a federal whistleblower complaint, brought a little bit of this to my attention. I took it from there, continued to investigate, got all this other data we've been talking about. Right now, with the investigators on the scene in Toma, he has been staging a sit-in in the hospital trying to get their attention. He tried all day yesterday to get them to talk to him, posting on Facebook. His name is Ryan Honnell, H-O-N-L. And at the end of the day, no one would talk to him, so he left. And, you know, now he's no longer working for the VA. He has another job. So today, as I understand it, he's operating his forklift for Goodwill again. But I'm sure he'll be back trying to make sure that this doesn't go away.
Now, Senator Tammy Baldwin has been taking some heat over all of this, especially after it was reported that she had a similar report on the Toma VA's practices sitting on her desk apparently for months. How has her office reacted in the last couple of weeks?
Well, I think it's important to note that she had this report from the Office of Inspector General in March 2014. The report was published in March 2014. She supposedly, according to her, got it in August 2014. No one else saw it until I reported on it, which is extremely rare. You know, usually these inspector general's reports are published on the agency's website. Any member of the public can go read them, find out what's wrong, find out how the VA is trying to fix problems that affect our veterans. They're also usually shared with members of Congress, especially the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committees, who get a briefing. In this case, no one was officially given a copy of the report. The report was not placed online. I only found out about it through a leak. Tammy Baldwin, though, had apparently asked about this from a constituent. She got a copy of it in August, she said, and she didn't really act on it. She didn't really do anything. And so now she's got a lot of egg on her face, a lot of explaining to do about why she didn't take action until we ran our story and all of this became public. I should say that she's not the only member of Congress who was appraised of these problems. Congressman Ron Kind, people approached him back in 2011. He referred the matter to the inspector general and then kind of checked out and didn't do any follow-up until we published our story. Senator Ron Johnson was contacted by the whistleblower, Ryan Honnell, that we were talking about in October. His staff showed initial interest and then kind of brushed him aside. Secretary of Veterans Affairs Bob McDonald was peppered with emails from Honnell and other whistleblowers at the facility, told them that he would investigate, but didn't take any public action until our story ran. So I feel like it's a little bit unfair that Tammy Baldwin is getting the brunt of kind of the negative media coverage in Wisconsin, when really what we're seeing is a complete and utter failure by the entire political class to react to something until it's made public by the media.
The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is investigating the Toma facility. What do you expect to happen next?
It's a good question. A lot of people wonder what is going to happen next. We talked about the fact that Dr. Houlihan, the chief of staff of the hospital, who, you know, not only was writing all these prescriptions, but also, you know, many quality health practitioners quit. They wanted to help veterans. They didn't feel like they could do it. They worried about reprisal. The Inspector General's report that we were talking about earlier mentioned four pharmacists who left the hospital saying they were worried that their professional licenses would be at risk because of the practices that they engaged. And I talked to many, many former staff, many veterans themselves, who felt like they could no longer work there for Dr. Houlihan. So, you know, one possibility is investigators find nothing. He comes back. He's the boss. He's the chief of staff again. Everything's back to normal. Another possibility is that he's fired. A new leadership team is brought in, and they begin to reorient the care at the hospital away from narcotics and towards more integrative, healthful health care, and try to create a more constructive, helpful work environment where employees can treat veterans in an ethical manner or a manner they feel is ethical. It's really hard to tell. VA doesn't have a great track record on this. You remember last year with the scandal in Phoenix, you know, there was the allegation of secret lists, secret wait times, veterans who died waiting on secret lists. Secretary Eric Shinseki, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, was forced to resign. Now everything is supposed to be different under the new Secretary, Bob McDonald. And yet, you know, we revealed in our story that on his watch, this report about Tomo was suppressed until we at the Center for Investigative Reporting revealed it.
So a big to be continued there. We'll be watching it along with you. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Take care.
That was Aaron Glanz, veterans reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Today, the U.S. Senate is beginning to consider President Obama's nomination for Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
Also, the president has set a record for issuing the most veto threats of any president this soon into a legislative session. And on Monday, officials at the Koch brothers political organization announced they're planning to spend $889 million on getting Republicans elected in 2016.
USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer is with us. He joins us every week at this time to share the lowdown on Congress. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks a lot for having me back, Veronica.
So AG nominee Loretta Lynch was at her Senate confirmation hearing today. What happened?
I think it's even still going on, even as we speak. There was not a lot of fireworks. I mean, I think the general takeaway here is that senators think she's okay, but they really hate Eric Holder, her predecessor. And so much of the time was spent saying, essentially, "You're not Eric Holder, are you?" And she would say, no, I'll be my own person. And they're like, okay, because we really hate Eric Holder. You know, there's still a great deal of frustration amongst Republicans in the Senate over President Obama's executive action on immigration, which extends – it basically protects about 5 million people from deportation. That was done on a legal basis that was crafted by the Justice Department under Eric Holder. Ms. Lynch said she didn't see a reason why that was wrong. She stood by that legal argument. But nevertheless, she is trying to sort of suggest she'll be more cooperative with Congress and build, try to rebuild that relationship. We'll see how that goes.
Republican Senator David Vitter from Louisiana has said he'd oppose her nomination. Do you know what kind of grievances Republican lawmakers have with her, aside from the whole Eric Holder thing?
No, they don't have any grievances with her at all. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, by and large, I don't think anybody's ever said, gosh, Ms. Lynch, you're terrible on the following three things. I mean, I think the issue is they believe this administration has violated the law and the Constitution in several places by essentially trying to reinterpret laws or choosing which portions to enforce, I think is the way they would phrase it. And they think that that is a really bad precedent, and they would like her to stand up and say, well, I won't let the president get away with that. Now, she was not about to say any of that, but she was at least willing to say to them, you know, I will make my own decisions and I'll be independent of the president.
And is that likely to make her case and sell it to lawmakers, or do you expect this to be a more contentious confirmation process?
No, I think she'll be confirmed. She's got a pretty strong background for this. She's an extremely well-qualified legal professional. She's an African-American woman, hard to oppose in some cases for some of these Republican lawmakers. You know, I mean, I don't think they're going to vote against her. I think they're using the opportunity to vent their frustrations with the administration in other areas.
Moving on to the president, some news about the number of vetoes he's made since January. That number so far, I guess, sits at 8, which is a lot for now. You know, he hasn't done a lot prior to that, but 8 is a big number. It's drawing some attention. What do you think about that number?
Well, it's drawing some attention because my colleague Gregory Cordy wrote a story where he sort of ran through all these numbers and dug it up. And, you know, it's an interesting number. I mean, obviously, Obama didn't have to veto anything in the previous years because he had a Democratic Senate protecting him from bad legislation, that is, legislation he didn't want to have to sign. So I think maybe he had a couple of veto threats over the past 6 years. But now it's been, what did we say, 8 in a couple of weeks? And that's because, you know, Obama will blame the Republicans and say, well, look, the Republican Senate and the Republicans in the House are suddenly trying to march up here all these bills they know I can't sign, like a bill that would prohibit abortions after 20 weeks, or a bill that would force through the XL pipeline. These things that he's already said in the past he's not going to sign. Now, the Republicans see it as an indication that he is not going to work with them and that his calls for bipartisanship are a fraud. And the fact of the matter is he's just going to say no. Take it what you will. I mean, I will say, I have this terrific story and a really interesting way to look at the thing. You know, we have a fairly small sample size here. We've got, you know, less than a dozen veto threats in less than 3 weeks of this Congress. So let's see what happens over the next few weeks, whether this relationship evens out or this becomes the basic process for the next 18 months. Congress comes up with an idea, president threatens veto, we argue over it, it never passes anyway.
Does the threat itself matter a lot? We're talking about threats and not actual vetoes at this point, so is it just...
And Cordy did find a couple of people who had told him that their votes change after a White House veto threat. There was one piece of legislation. They said they didn't really, a couple of Democrats said they didn't think that the legislation was that big a deal, and they were willing to vote for it. After the president said he would veto it, then they said, well, okay, then we'll vote against it. So it can have an impact, a significant impact. The question is, you know, whether these are bills that are really that marginal in the first place. I mean, are they, when I say that, if it's a narrow count one way or the other, maybe the presidential veto threat makes a difference, but they probably would have known already that that was coming down the road.
If you're a lawmaker, maybe especially a Democrat at this time, and you vote for something that the president does go on to veto, how big a deal is that politically?
It's a very big deal, and in some cases, you know, the Democrats are going to be in a very interesting position where they have to either vote no on a bill that they're going to take some abuse for back home. The XL pipeline would be a good example. You know, if you vote no on the pipeline and you're from some state that, you know, thinks it's a good project, then you might really take some abuse from that in your next reelection campaign or from your constituents back home. On the other hand, if you vote yes for it and then the president says no, then you're in this position of essentially opposing the president from your party. Is that good for you either? You know, it can be a very uncomfortable position. Now, of course, the threshold for overcoming a presidential veto is higher than the threshold for passing the law in the first place. So for some members, it may be easy to say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll vote for the bill, but I won't vote to override the veto.
Well, we're going to talk money right now. Officials at the Koch brothers' political organization said on Monday that they're going to spend around $900 million backing Republicans for 2016. We're already talking 2016. What's your first reaction to that?
My first reaction is $900 million.
Well, put it into context. How much money is that in the pantheon of political fundraising?
My understanding is that is something more than double what the Republican National Committee spent during the 2012 presidential cycle. In 2012, the RNC, that is the Republican Party, spent $400 million. So this is an outside group, and basically it's a small group of very wealthy donors who are going to run an operation that will be as big, if not larger, than the party operations for the Democrats and Republicans. That's amazing. Now, I will say that because there's so much money in the system now, anyhow, that, you know, $1 billion might not be the dominant voice. There will be others. I mean, I would not be surprised to see Hillary Clinton raise $1 billion, assuming she runs. But still, I mean, it is now essentially a political party of its own, which is fairly remarkable.
And, Paul, how bad is this for Democrats, do you think? I mean, is it something that, as you said, is not going to be the lead? It could be a factor, but maybe not the whole ballgame.
Right. I mean, I think for Democrats, they have to be serious and they have to be concerned about facing opposition. I mean, you saw in the 20... What year are we in now? Right. So the 2014 election cycle, the same group, the sort of Koch-affiliated organizations, spent a lot of money and beat a lot of Democrats in some close races. So if you are a Democrat facing this, I think you have to take very, very seriously. You have a well-funded opposition, so do not take it lightly.
We're going to leave it there. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica. I'll talk to you soon.
We've been talking with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to talk about what our lawmakers are up to in Congress.
Each campus in the UW system is unique in the way it spends money on student activities and building projects. But in order to deal with continuing state budget cuts and high education costs, UW system officials are taking a hard look at both of those. In the first of a three-part series looking at possible reforms in the UW system, Maureen McCollum takes a closer look at what the changes could mean at UW La Crosse.
Inside the UWL Recreational Eagle Center, groups of college students take turns shooting basketballs. On the track circling above them, other students are running laps in neon-colored workout gear. Last spring, UWL students overwhelmingly approved an $8 million expansion of the rec center.
The bottom of the expansion will be a brand new kind of strength center, workout cardio facility, which is fantastic.
UWL Student Association President Kaylee Otterbacher says students will pay an extra $14 annually in segregated fees to finance the project. Seg fees cost UWL students about $1,200 per year and fund the student union, a sustainability initiative, and textbook rental, campus programs that do not get state support.
You know, I think for what you get, they are fair. The thing is, those seg fees might be high. They're all student-centered programs, and so they're programs that typically students have voted on that students want.
But the future of the rec center expansion is up in the air. Campus officials are hoping it will be included in the state's upcoming biennial budget, but with the governor looking to cut $300 million from the UW system, it's unclear if there's room for it. Plus, at the December Board of Regents meeting, UW System President Ray Cross said all existing and future seg fees would be subjected to unprecedented scrutiny.
As we all know, every campus has become more reliant on segregated fees, especially in the last decade or so. And we intend to do a better job of accounting for those fees and finding ways to reduce them wherever possible.
In fact, segregated fees have doubled at most of UW's four-year campuses over the last decade. Now, the average yearly seg fee is almost $1,250. Kaylee Otterbacher will be serving as a student representative on UW System's committee exploring seg fee reform. She says the cost of higher education is getting too expensive, but she says it should be up to students on individual campuses to increase or decrease seg fees, not the system.
It's not my job at UW La Crosse to decide what's best for UW Green Bay. It's not fair. Students elect their leaders. They're supposed to do that. That's the way it's always been done.
Along with segregated fees, President Cross wants to reform the approval process for campus building projects. UW facilities are generally funded two ways, through program revenue, like seg fees, and through state bonding.
I can only speak for our campus, and we think that everything we bring to the Regents is justified and important.
UW La Crosse Chancellor Joe Gao says it's difficult to tell how the UW system could change the approval standards since building proposals are already thoroughly vetted. There are eight major building projects underway at UWL, and the future is uncertain for half of them. Gao says he's concerned about getting a new residence hall approved, along with the student-backed rec center.
These are times when things that used to be pretty secure are not necessarily that way.
Building projects and segregated fees are just pieces of the UW budget conversation taking place right now. President Cross says he wants to keep education affordable while maintaining excellence. Whether expanding UWL's rec center and adding treadmills fits into those goals, that's ultimately up to the governor and the legislature. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
Wisconsin's political divide has heated up in recent years. While things right now may not be as stormy as they were during the 2011 protests at the Capitol, people who watch the numbers, including in a recent analysis of the last governor's race from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, find partisan lines getting more and more entrenched.
That's when it comes to voting, but how does this play out in our daily lives and in the way we interact with other Wisconsinites? Back in 2011, there were reports of grudges, family arguments, and broken friendships because of political disputes, and strong regional differences have emerged too.
Kathy Kramer has been thinking about these issues for years now and talking to people around the state about them. She's a political science professor at UW-Madison, also the interim director of the Morgridge Center for Public Service. Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you've joined us here and on the Joy Cardine Show over the years to talk about these kind of issues. A few years out from the protests, another governor's election behind us, do you see the divisiveness going down, or is it locked in to stay for a while?
I think it's quieter now, but I think it feels locked in. It seems locked in some respects. And, you know, every time an election cycle comes around, things seem to ramp up. So it's still with us.
And when you talk to people around the state, compared to the way things were 5, maybe 10 years ago, are we different? Do we talk differently about politics than we used to?
We do. In fact, one of the big things we see is people not talking about politics, avoiding talking about politics. So when I first started visiting groups in 2007, people would, and these are groups of folks, you know, just hanging out together in gas stations or diners or other gathering places like that, people would have very lively conversations about politics, but around 2010, 2011, 2012, what I saw was people who had these long-time relationships with folks just didn't talk about politics, avoided it. They had agreed to not talk about it because they valued their friendships and didn't want to get into irreparable fights.
That's probably, I guess, good for our friendships and our relationships with family. Are we losing something, though, as in civic society if we're not having those conversations?
Absolutely. On the one hand, democracy is about having debates, maybe even heated debates, right? We're supposed to be able to express our opinions and have differences. But when these differences become so personal that we can't even engage one another about public issues, then in a lot of respects, it's not really a democracy. It's the people aren't involved in kind of debating the issues of the day or even, you know, hearing other perspectives. And yeah, we're definitely losing something.
So where is it coming from? Is there something about us changing, or is there something about the way politics works that's changing and we're responding to that?
Yeah, both. I think it goes hand in hand. So it's hard to say in some respects, whether it's our leaders who are teaching us how to treat one another or our leaders tapping into the way we're treating one another, but they feed on each other. So, for example, the polarization among our elected officials is not a great model for those of us in the public, but it is true that though that polarization is effective, partly because of the way just our political institutions are set up, it's in the interest of politicians to have clear partisan divides in some respects. But, you know, they tap into divides in public sentiment, and then the ball keeps rolling. So it's partly the fault of our leaders, but we're also teaching this way of behaving to one another and to our young folks.
Now, you study also regional divides in the state, looking at how people, say, in rural communities view Madison, vice versa. How much overlap is that kind of where you live difference in the way we talk about politics?
Yeah, I see a big overlap in it, whether we're talking about rural versus urban areas or even, say, the Milwaukee suburban areas versus the city of Milwaukee itself. There are just a lot of our political divides in the state, as in other parts of the country, correlate pretty strongly with geographic areas. So, where you grow up has something to do with how you think about politics. And if the kind of people are having a hard time engaging people of other perspectives, and politics is somewhat intertwined these days with our cultural differences or how we grew up, and I think that's what makes a lot of the divides hard to overcome.
Yeah, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had some research of that Milwaukee region that you were talking about, and I think they looked at something like 90 different units of government, and like elections, and only 8 of them or something like that were divided by single digits. The rest were overwhelmingly Republican or overwhelmingly Democratic. So it seems like it might be possible for a lot of people to go through their day never encountering somebody they disagree with.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So when you don't have a personal relationship with somebody who thinks politically pretty differently than you, it's easy to demonize the other side and to not see those folks as equally human, and that it makes it easier to just tune out other opinions and other perspectives. So, yeah, even in an area that's, say, divided 60-40 or 70-30 politically, meaning between Democrats and Republicans, you're likely to encounter people from the other side. But when it gets to, like, 80-20 versus 90-10, the chances are pretty few and far between that people in that small of a minority are going to be willing to speak up and explain to you what they're thinking.
We're talking to UW political scientist Kathy Kramer about Wisconsin's political divide and how it changes the way we talk about politics, or even if we bother to talk about politics in the first place.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you had difficult times with friends or family, coworkers, neighbors, because of political differences? Have you maybe unfriended someone or otherwise cut your online ties based on arguments over an issue? Are you worried that both sides of the issue are just talking past one another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about political conversation in Wisconsin. Recent voting numbers find that the partisan lines are getting more firmly entrenched, and we want to know how that's playing out in the way that we get along with each other.
And you can join us with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you talk about politics? Do you talk about politics with people who have a different opinion than you? Can you do it in a civil way, or has it broken up friendships, made for some awkward family moments? And why are we so divided in the state? 800-642-1234 is the number to call or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. We've got Kathy Kramer with us, by the way, professor of political science at UW-Madison, and Denny in Waupaca joins us now. Denny, hi.
Hi. My issue, I'm a political guy. I've studied it my whole life. I'm an independent voter. My partner in business is also. We study hard data, not, you know, numbers and debts. And what stuns us is how little the average voter knows. And I don't care which side of the aisle he is on. And then when you get onto a subject where you can hand them hard data, angry with you if it doesn't meet what their thought process is trying to say. So that's, I think, really an issue, because I think Church said, if you want to know why democracy can't work over the long haul, just spend 5 minutes talking to the average voter.
Denny,
that's an issue for me.
Denny, thanks a lot for that call. So one problem Denny sees, Kathy, is that once we set an opinion, we can be impervious to facts if they're contradictory to what we already think.
Yeah, Yeah, it's kind of sad, and I have two opinions on that topic, I think. One is that I worry that the average American voter is denigrated way more than he or she ought to be. When I talk with people, just listening to them talk about politics, I often find that people have pretty sophisticated reasons for why they think what they do. But on the other hand, it's hard to ignore all the studies in the past decade or so showing how little facts really matter for what people think. We almost everybody perceives political issues through their own particular lenses, and if you're predisposed to think one way or another about an issue, it's very common that people discount controverting evidence. So then he's right that, you know, there's a lack of using information going on among voters.
Denny, thanks for that. Building on that, Kristen on Facebook lists some things that make dialogue difficult. Two of those fit in. She says fragmentation of the media and the rise of opinion-based news fosters confirmation bias, she says, so we select the media that already agrees with us. And spin and truthiness, we can't agree on simple facts of the matter, she says, in many issues, thus no rational discussion can follow.
It puts us in quite a bind, doesn't it? I mean, it is easy to select on information that confirms your prior opinion these days. It's easier and easier in a lot of ways. And it's so unlike in the past when there were, you know, three television channels that everybody was watching at dinner time and you couldn't really avoid the news. There just are not a whole lot of common sources of news anymore. And, you know, WPR did not pay me to say this, but thank goodness for WPR and some public venues of information where, you know, many people can get access to news that covers a range of opinions. So there still are, you know, there still are some mediums for political information that cover a range of views, but she's right that it's easy to tune in only to what you want to hear.
Get back to our callers now. Clarence is with us in Watertown. Clarence, hi.
Good afternoon. A lot of it is our occupations. I am one of seven siblings, and five of the seven signed the recall petition. The other two donated to Scott Walker. A lot of it's our occupation. The two of us are self-employed. We are responsible for the success of our businesses. And the other four of the other five are very, very large union backers. And so when we get together, family get-togethers and things, we just simply avoid politics.
But Clarence, thanks a lot for the call. Kathy, division not just by region, not just by politics, but by occupation, even within their family there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if it's more common these days or not, but especially with the recent recession and just the economic state of things these days and economic inequality, it seems that occupation has a lot to do with how we feel about politics. And, you know, occupation as partly is about how we spend our time, but also just our livelihood. And it's unfortunate that that has to be a source of divide, but it certainly seems to be the case. And I'd be interested to hear, I'm guessing Clarence isn't still on the line, but if occupation has always been a divide with his siblings, or if that's something that he thinks has become more of an issue in recent years.
Actually, Clarence, briefly, you are still on the line. Your thoughts.
Oh, great.
Yes. We're all raised in the same house, same parents. Parents are very staunch conservatives. But as the children, you know, grew up and moved away and married, and their spouses has had occupations, It that branched into it. I know one of my younger siblings, his wife is in the school system. She's a teacher's aide. And, you know, when they go to the polls, they always cancel each other out.
Interesting. Clarence, thanks a lot. And thanks for following that up. I want to get a couple more callers, and I think we'll go to Mike in Madison now. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of say that what bothers me the most, and the reason I think everything has gotten so contentious in the state, is the majority of people seem to have sort of a football fan mentality about the two parties. They'll support them whether they're right, wrong, or indifferent, and the issues don't really seem to matter anymore. So it just becomes a shouting contest of my team's better than yours.
Michael, thanks. So we fall into Team Red against Team Blue, Kathy.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think for a lot of people, politics is much more about identity than it is about facts or the specifics of issues. So we sort of have a sense of what Republicans are like and whom they're for, and the same with Democrats, and we align ourselves accordingly, according to those perceptions. So oftentimes it's not about where we stand on the issues, but sort of what team we feel we're a part of.
Michael joins us next in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hi. Hi, Professor Kramer. Thanks so much for the work that you've done on this. I have been following it over the past few years. And just wanted to let you know that right here in Madison, we do have a group I do some volunteer work for called Reach Out Wisconsin. It doesn't address so much the political divide. That's not really the point. We're not trying to convert each other. It addresses the human divide, you know, the human impact that the that the terrible, the terrible things that can happen on the human level due to this political split. We get together once every 2 or 3 months or so, liberals, conservatives. We pick an issue and we discuss it. It's really more about understanding the other side and making sure that everyone knows that the folks on the other side have a very good reason for believing what they do. It's not because they're dumb or evil or something like that. It's really about exposure more than anything. It's reachoutwisconsin.org is our website.
Michael, thanks a lot. Kathy, I know you take these issues personally. This isn't just an abstract issue. Hearing something like that, Reach Out Wisconsin, similar efforts, does that give you hope that we can still get along, be civil with each other here in Wisconsin?
Oh, I absolutely do. I think that's fantastic. Michael, thank you for your thoughts and for calling in. I've read about your group, and I'm a fan from afar. I think that is what it takes, I think, is just folks taking it into their own hands to take the time and have the patience to hear different points of view. It is possible, but it takes a special effort these days.
All right. Well, Kathy, thanks for joining us. Hope we can continue this conversation over the next months.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm thankful to you for focusing on the issue. Thanks.
That was Kathy Kramer. She's a professor of political science at UW-Madison. She is also the interim director of the Morgridge Center for Public Service. You can keep this conversation going on, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page. Our producer, Chris Molina, caught this cultural milestone. Today is the 30th anniversary of the recording session for We Are the World. That's the USA for Africa fundraising song aimed at poverty relief in Africa.
The song was written by Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson, and the recording session brought them together with a huge all-star group of singers like Diana Ross, Stevie Wonder, Bruce Springsteen, Willie Nelson, and on and on.
Yeah, this was huge. When it came out, it was every American pop star, it seemed like, at the time. And it even inspired, I was at a summer music program, and we did an all-star rendition of this. I sang, I don't know, I got the Bruce Springsteen part or something. It's one of those rare instances where people got to hear me, I'll throw it in quotes, sing in front of people.
I can't hear that song without thinking of shoulder pads and neon shoelaces. Mm-hmm. Now it's so smacks of the 80s.
Yeah.
I can't tell whether it's a good song anymore or not, but I like it because it's kind of a time capsule of the 80s.
It is, and I was watching the video of this, recording it earlier, and I mean, yeah, it's a little smarmy, but I mean, so many legends in one room,
it's
on one
so
stage.
It's so cool to see Michael Jackson in his prime. Yeah. With the white glove on and everything in the video.
Well, we'll go out to the news with We Are the World, recorded 30 years ago today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
God's great big family.